Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. My name is Zane Seyfried. We're here today with a very special guest, Michael Lee Stollard. Michael is a co-founder and president of E Pluribus Partners, helping leaders elevate productivity and innovation by increasing employee engagement and connection. He's a guest columnist everywhere, it seems, from Forbes to Inc. magazine. He's recently partnered with Texas Christian University to create a Center for Connection Culture. In his free time, he's managed to write another great book titled The Connection Culture, The Competitive Advantage of Shared Identity, Empathy, and Understanding at Work. And that's what we're here to talk about. Michael, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Zane. It's good to be with you.
Now, let's get to the heart of the matter. Who needs to read The Connection Culture?
Anyone who works.
Okay.
And I say that because the gist of the book, Zane, is about how the interactions we have in the workplace affect us as human beings. So it gets into the biology, looking at research on that, and it turns out that it has a profound effect on us in terms of our productivity, the joy we experience in life, our health, and our lifespan. And so it's really relevant to everyone in the workplace, and it's especially relevant to leaders because they have the greatest influence on creating cultures. But not all cultures are the same, and that's what this book about is helping, giving leaders and people a language to understand what is culture, and secondly, what are the best, what cultures are out there that are relevant in the workplace, and how do I create the best culture?
Now, one of the trends I like most in the employee engagement conversation is a renewed focus on what you just touched on, which is the biology of employee engagement, of engaged employees and disengaged employees. You recently retweeted an article from the New York Times talking about how the heavy workload and the extensive hours are breaking this culture of connection. Can you talk a little bit about that? Just briefly.
Sure, you bet. And it kind of factors into what I'm writing about for my next book, actually, which is after World War II, America, if you looked at the health, both mental and physical health of Americans, versus the wealthy countries of the world, we were at the top. But over the course of the last 60 years or so, we've gradually seen our health decline so that the Institute of Medicine, which is a very prestigious national academy, benchmarked the health of Americans under 50 years old and compared it to the data for the 16 other affluent countries in the world. And Americans under 50 now have the lowest life expectancy versus the other country. In fact, in 9 health outcomes, we ranked dead last, including infant mortality. When I share this data with people, it's shocking because we've drifted from being the healthiest to being the least healthy of the affluent countries, and I think the drift, Zane, has been so gradual that we haven't noticed how our culture has become unhealthy, and that's part of what this book is about. Is we're hardwired to connect, and when those needs are not met, it affects us in every way.
You know, that's just amazing. Here we have, the greatest economy. We're supposed to have the greatest healthcare system in the world. And during the period where hours work has continued to increase, including, and that doesn't even begin to include the different stresses from, moving to part-time employees and contractors and all of that, that the most important asset for a company has now become the most abused asset for the company. And I hate that term, asset, in regards to, people, our friends and peers and colleagues.
Right, that's true. And when you step back, it's not only that people are working longer hours. Just to take a little broader perspective for a minute, they're working longer hours, but they're also, Zane, in workplaces that are less relationship friendly. So, for example, if you go out to lunch with a colleague and you're not having lunch at your desk, you're viewed as a slacker in the culture. I certainly saw that when I worked for years on Wall Street. There's that pressure for FaceTime. And there's a professor at Wharton who's actually done some research and shown that 25% of the people who work on Wall Street are struggling with mental health issues, which ultimately comes down, I believe, to primarily loneliness. But just some other factors to mention them are not only are we working longer hours in a less relationship-friendly workplace, but commutes are longer, families have spread out, people are less involved in community groups, you know, whether it's faith groups like the churches or synagogues or the Boy Scouts or what have you. We've just become a lonelier culture, and because we're hardwired to connect as human beings, when that need isn't met, we dysfunction. And that's what we're seeing in the data, is that the mental and physical health of Americans is sliding. And there are a number of factors that could contribute to it, but I believe the primary factor is just that need that we have as human beings for relational support in life is not being met, and it makes us more vulnerable to stress, anxiety, depression, and ultimately to addiction.
Crystal clear, thank you. Years ago, Vern Hornish outlined three questions that seem to drive all of our decisions. I'll play the role of a leader who's listening in on the conversation today, and I'll ask them from their perspective. So, Michael, what's in it for me? What's in the connection culture for me as a leader of my organization or a team?
Well, leaders are creating one of three cultures, and Zane, the three cultures are, first of all, a culture of control, and that's where people who have power, control, influence, status, rule over others, and that has a negative effect on connection. The second, which we see growing in our research, is the culture of indifference, where people are just so busy with email, too much information, texts, et cetera, that they don't take time to build healthy, supportive relationships in the workplace and in life outside of work. And that this need for connection is not being met because of that. So that's the second type, the culture of indifference. And the third type is the culture of connection, where people feel connected to their coworkers, to their supervisor, to the work they do because it's a good fit with their strengths and provides the right degree of challenge. They also feel connected to the organization's mission, its values, its reputation, and those connections really have a grounding effect on us, and they just help make us more resilient against stress and anxiety.
Now, why should I care? I mean, I got work to do, I got deadlines, I got write-ups that I need to deliver. Why should I care that shared identity and empathy and understanding at work? I mean, we're here to work. We're not here to talk about feelings.
Well, that's true. We're here to work, but that's why you should care, because the research shows that when people feel connected, it makes them more productive, it makes them better decision makers, it makes them more creative, and when you create cultures of connection, Zane, it impacts organizations in five distinct ways that provide a powerful competitive advantage. Number one, when people feel connected, like I said, they're better decision makers, more creative. So it helps improve an individual's performance. Secondly, when they feel connected in the culture, they give their best efforts, so it boosts employee engagement. Third, when they feel connected, they align their behavior with the leader's goals so that more people are moving in the same direction rather than in different directions where there's a lack of alignment. The next benefit is they communicate better because they care. They're willing to take a risk and share something with the boss that he or she may not want to hear, but they need to hear to make the best decisions. So they care about the work of the group, and they'll speak up. And then finally, they also think about and take action and try to improve the work of the group. In other words, they contribute to innovation. Those are five sources of competitive advantage that add up to a pretty powerful effect on the bottom line.
Okay, every one of those points resonates with me. You know, better decisions, great. That's take the burden off of me. Best efforts, great. You know, more productivity. Align with my goals, align with the leader's goals, great. Communicate better. I mean, that'll save a lot of meetings where I have to, you know, adjudicate communication problems. They'll be leaders. They'll take action. All good. But why should I believe? I mean, you're asking me to take a big leap of faith to start embracing these recommendations in your book?
Well,
why should I believe?
The reaction I have to the book, Zane, is the leaders who understand this embrace it. Say Admiral Vern Clark, the former chief of the Navy, he wrote an endorsement of the book that's on the back cover. And he understands how people are wired. He's been a wildly successful leader when he became the chief of the U.S. Navy in 2000, and within 18 months, first-term reenlistment in the Navy soared from under 38% to 57%. So you have the leaders who understand it. The leaders who don't understand it as much because they don't really, and people have different sensitivities when it comes to needs for connection. Some people have a high need for connection, other people have a low need. And I often work in those cultures where people have a low need, you know, the engineering section at the Johnson Space Center, MD Anderson Cancer Center. You'll find a lot of scientists and engineers who, you know, are more task-driven. But what's in it for them is really the scientific case is part of the book. There's a whole chapter on the science of connection where I tried to sum up the effects of connection versus feeling left out, unsupported, or lonely, which has a very bad effect on us from a biological standpoint. I tried to describe the research on that. And then secondly, I shifted and looked at the research on connection and engagement in organizations. And then the third part of that research chapter is how are we doing in terms of connection? And the answer is not good in organizations or in life outside of work. And that's why I believe Americans are dysfunctioning, especially Americans under 50. We see the older generations are not struggling with these issues as much. You know, this is kind of the Eisenhower generation who's up there in years now. They're doing okay. It's the younger generations, I think, because we're more engaged in social media, we have more engaging things to watch on television these days, working longer hours, et cetera, and all those factors kind of add up where we've squeezed out time for relationships in our life.
Now let's read one line from that testimonial from Vernon Clark. This is his last line, and it's so great. This is more than a great read. Michael's connection strategy is a game changer for leaders. And I want to encourage everyone listening to go buy a copy of Michael's book because it gives a great case study, a profile of Vernon Clark, Admiral, U.S. Navy, former Chief of Naval Operations, and how he turned around recruiting in the Navy in a very short period of time with all the positive results on performance and savings and budgets and all of that. So it's a great read. Go get the book. Read about Vernon Clark, among many others. Now, you've helped many companies create their connection cultures. You've worked, they're all in different industries and different growth stages and sizes. You've worked with nonprofits. But I'm willing to bet they share a lot in common. What's the most important common element they share as it relates to the connection culture?
Well, what they share is the same pattern of three factors in a culture that create connection. And I just call them vision, value, voice. And maybe a better way to describe them is when a leader communicates an inspiring vision, values people, and gives them a voice, it creates connection. And that's when they give their best efforts, align their behavior, et cetera. So it's kind of simple on its surface. What's been interesting in our work for us, Zane, is just that there's such a wide variety of ways that leaders connect with people and create a connection culture, whether it's the U.S. Navy like Admiral Clark or Frances Hasselbein creating a connection culture for the Girl Scouts or Chris Winters, the headmaster at Greenwich High School in Connecticut, creating a connection culture for faculty, staff, and students. You know, there are just different approaches to this, and that's what we've been gathering for the past 12 years is how do we see leaders, you know, they're creating vision, value, voice, but they do it in different ways. They use, they have similar attitudes. They will sometimes use different language in how they describe it. And their behaviors can be very different, individual behaviors and institutional behaviors. But they do have some things in common, and they tend to fall under those three, what we call the 3V leadership model, vision, value, voice.
Excellent. Now, when you talk to these leaders in creating a connection culture, you know, I can see many of them nodding their head and saying, you know, Michael, you know, you're absolutely right. I'm on board. But what's a but in their argument, and how do you help them get past it?
Well, it's
that's a
great
mournful
question.
Painful.
You know, well, I'll tell you, my approach, Zane, to be honest, is to really look for the leaders who believe in it, who I know will execute it and work with them.
Yep.
And I describe them in two ways. They're leaders who care about people and care about results. And that's who I focus on working on. But when I go into sections like, say, the Johnson, the engineering section of the Johnson Space Center, or across town at the MD Anderson Cancer Center where you're working with scientists and doctors, we'll spend half a day on the research, and I'll just tell them, hey, listen, I can keep going on this all day if you want. You know, I can show you study after study. So unless you're just irrational, if you're rational, this research clearly shows it is rational to be intentional about creating connection. So what are you going to do about it? And so I try to defang the rational, you know, their misperceptions about connection, because maybe they don't feel it as much, but that doesn't mean others don't feel it. And it also doesn't mean that it doesn't have an effect on them from a subconscious level, because we have, you know, our right brain hemisphere processes things on a subconscious level, and we pick up how people are treating us in the culture. And you clearly see that in research, that what happens when we feel threatened, even if it's a subconscious threat, that the body goes into a state of stress response, and it sends blood, glucose, and oxygen to the heart, the lungs, the thighs, because it's preparing to fight or flee. But it takes those same resources from the brain, so it affects memory, from the digestive system, so that we're more prone to, you know, upset stomach, colitis, acid reflux, digestive disorders like that. And we're more vulnerable to sickness and disease, because it's taking that blood, glucose, and oxygen from our immune system, too. It also affects the reproductive system, by the way. But so it's it has a profound effect on our bodies when we feel threatened, and when we're in that state of homeostasis, so the body gets all the body systems get the blood, glucose, and oxygen they need to operate in a healthy, sustainable way, then, you know, it's that connection culture that provides that safety that helps us perform at the top of our game for a long period of time. And of course that affects, if people are performing at the top of their game, the organization's performing at the top of its game as well.
You know, it seems so obvious, even for this art major, myself, you know, the data is so obvious if you're just willing to look at it. I love all the scientific research. I love what you're talking about with the blood and the glucose and the oxygen, and it's going to the thighs, and, you know, it's draining from the head, and you're getting ready to, you know, fight or flight across the boardroom table. But, you know, if you're the least bit observant, you can tell the logic of employee engagement just makes so much sense.
Right.
People happy just give. People happy take risk. People happy take initiative. They're patient. They're forgiving. They're cooperative. They go the extra mile. And I use this flippantly. You know, you don't need to be a rocket scientist to see this. But it's so great that, you know, those who prefer data as opposed to intuition or anecdotes, you know, now there's so much compelling research that documents what we're all experiencing around us.
Yeah,
now,
that's true. Go ahead. No, go right ahead.
In chapter two, you go into detail about these three elements that contribute to connection. You just touched on them a minute ago. They are vision, value, and voice. So how do they all work together and, you know, mesh to create a culture of connection?
Well, sometimes it helps just to tell a quick story and just an example. And they do, you know, there's some overlap. So, for example, one practice I talk about in the book, the knowledge flow session, it really touches on vision, value, and voice. But let me just give you a quick story, and I probably shared this story with your listeners before, but it was a long time ago, Zane. So who knows if anyone's
heard
that story.
Ago.
But a story I used that I think resonates, and I've used it in Europe and teaching workshops over there too, is just the story of the rock band U2. It's a really fascinating story of four 14- and 15-year-old boys who came together in the mid-70s. And when they started, they were not very good. They tended to scream more than sing, and their bass player had never taken lessons, and he couldn't keep time. So there were some serious problems with the band. And yet they persisted, and today they have been awarded more Grammy Awards than any band in history. And they surpassed the Rolling Stones, which is one of my favorite bands, with the highest revenue-producing concert tour in history. And if you look at those guys, they're relatively healthy. They may still keep going for another decade or two. It's a pretty phenomenal story. And when you look at their story, what you find out is that Bono, who's the leader, lead singer, and lyricist, and he would describe himself as, he probably wouldn't admit to being the leader, but if you observe the band, he's clearly a leader among equals, among partners, so to speak. And he communicates an inspiring vision. Their music is about human rights and social justice and matters of faith. Those are things that are important to them. He says, we're more than performers and musicians, we're salesmen who are traveling around, and our ideas are things we believe in are contained in the lyrics of our songs, and we also try to influence those matters in our work outside of our music through our influence. And he values people. You see that in many different ways. Rather than taking half the profits like most of the megastars of the rock bands do, he takes an equal split with the four band members and their manager. And he also appreciates the positive, unique contributions of his colleagues. He talks about how he's a lousy guitar player and keyboards player, which is a bit of an overstatement, I think. But he says it's because of these talented friends of his that together they bring the music to life. And why would he ever want to leave? Because he just being around them makes him a better person. Now, he's been around them for four decades now, so that's saying a lot. And you think of all that touring they do together, that's got to be a little difficult at times. But they really have almost a family-like culture. And you also see it in just how he's helped, and they've helped one another. So when Larry Mullen Jr., the drummer, his mother was hit and killed in a car accident about a year after they formed the band, Bono reached out and helped him through that. Bono had lost his mother a couple years earlier. She suddenly had a cerebral hemorrhage and passed away. And when Edge went through a divorce, the lead guitar player, Edge, Bono and the guys were there to help him get through that. When Adam Clayton developed a drug addiction, instead of throwing him overboard, they adopted the motto that we're all going to get through this alive. And you just see in also in the way they make decisions, if somebody strongly opposes a particular decision, they won't do it. And Bono says it's frustrating. It takes more time to do this because we have to work through our disagreements. But he said, we believe in the process. If everybody has a voice, it keeps us together and we produce better music. And, certainly the data, the numbers show that they're wildly successful. But you just think of those things, all those things create a sense of connection that have kept them together when most rock bands, even very talented rock bands like Aerosmith or the Eagles, another one of my favorite bands, but the Eagles had to stop performing for 14 years because they hated each other so much. And it was really tragic. I love the Eagles. They're so awesome. There actually was a documentary on it too, Zane, by the way, on Showtime. It's a 3-hour documentary. We really see that how their culture broke down.
Yeah. I was talking about football. The best division, there's a segue. The best Division I football team last year was the Horned Frogs of TCU, Texas Christian University. Your book includes a wonderful endorsement by TCU's chancellor, both for you, your book, and your work. And on the basis of that and your relationship and inspiration, he's announcing a new center, the Center for Connection Culture. How did this come about, and what's its future?
Well, TCU has historically had a good culture. They have a low student-teacher ratio. They have a they call it a teacher-scholar model, where they really look for professors who like to mentor students. And if they don't like to mentor students, they don't really belong at TCU. So they have a great culture. It's not just the faculty, although the faculty have a huge effect on the students. It's also the staff. It's amazing to see how the staff of the university reach out. I think when freshmen come into the university, within the first week, they're invited over to the homes. Now, this is a school of 10,000 students, so it's not easy to do. But they're invited into the homes of faculty and staff members. You know, talk about a great welcome. But there's so many things you could talk about at TCU where they're very intentional about encouraging relationships. And it's very relevant because when you look at the data, higher education is struggling with student suicide, with emotional health issues. And many of those issues, the risks are diminished when you have a strong relational culture that helps people support through the struggles they have just to learn and grow, and just the struggles we all have in life. So TCU wants to be intentional about creating the best connection culture in higher education and really being an example to others. So that's what we formed the center, and we're bringing education and training to different departments of the university, and also bringing in speakers who will speak on issues that are related to connection, just to raise awareness of how important this is in life.
That's so great. You know, again, congratulations on that.
Yeah, thank you, Zane. It's really a joy to work on.
I bet. We first spoke almost 5 years ago regarding your first great book, Fired Up or Burned Out. What's changed since then? Or let's put it in the positive. What's the most promising trend you've seen over those 5 years in corporate America for employee engagement?
Well, I'm starting to see more leaders who understand culture. Because you look at the data, and since we've had employee engagement surveys for more than a decade, the aggregate numbers have not changed. And we still have roughly the same number of disengaged employees and actively disengaged employees. And so I think more leaders are seeing that this is ultimately an issue of culture. It can't be solved by a quick program. There really has to be a systemic solution that requires training that affects people's attitudes, language, and behavior. And there has to be feedback mechanisms like employee engagement surveys. Now, a lot of people just implemented employee engagement surveys in a quick training program. It just really wasn't enough. You have to design interventions to help people with, mentoring and coaching. And so they're moving toward a systemic solution. It's slow, but I'm encouraged to see more leaders who recognize that and who are doing it.
Well, it's only been, 100 years in developing a disengaged culture. I'm speaking broadly, and
more than that,
might take another year or two.
Yeah.
Before we go, I need to give a mutual friend of ours wants to say hi. That's Stephen Lynch from Results.com. He asked me to just tell you hi. He's in New Zealand right now, but we're going to get him back up to the States real soon. So, Stephen, thanks for stopping by. Now,
yeah, Stephen's tremendous.
Let's say President Obama calls you. And as a matter of fact, that blinking line on your office phone is his office. And he says he'd like to meet with you in between a few world crises, a round of golf, and a pickup basketball game. And you're ushered into the Oval Office, and he's sitting behind his desk. And after you shake hands, he says, "Michael, the fabric of our country is unraveling, and I'm interested in your three ideas to reinstill our nation's culture of connection." What would you tell him?
I would tell him what I tell everyone, which is to focus on what you can change. And I would, rather than creating a new federal government program to educate people about connection culture, as much as I would benefit from that, I would say, focus on federal government and creating, empowering leaders in federal government, with the training and the systemic solutions to help them create connection cultures. And if you do that, they'll be a great example. It'll make our government more efficient and more effective. You'd be leading by example. So focus, and this is, I say the same thing in the context of organizations. You know, don't worry about the CEO. You can't control him or her. And just focus on your own team, and because that's what matters the most. It's the culture that you're living in and day out that has the greatest impact on you, and that's the one you can influence the most. So just focus on what you can change, and don't worry about the rest.
Beautiful. That's so great. Thank you. Now, leaders are readers. Jim Rohn says that, and I just quote him. What are you reading these days, fiction or non?
Well, I'm reading two things. One is Edmund Morris's controversial book on Ronald Reagan called Dutch, because my daughter actually stayed up all night reading it, and I thought, wow, it must be good if she stayed up all night reading it. That's really something. So she recommended it, and I'm really loving it. It's a great book. And the second one is I'm rereading a classic. It's Parker Palmer's masterpiece called Let Your Life Speak, which is about, it's his story. The subtitle is Finding the Voice of Vocation. And it's really his story and wisdom about just his journey to find what his life's work was. And there's a lot of, it's beautiful writing, there's a lot of wisdom in the book. So I highly recommend it to people who are trying to figure out just their direction in life. It's a great book.
Fantastic. Michael, we got to go. I hate to say this. I know you got a million things going on. We promised 30 minutes. I could talk to you for hours because I love your work, love your book. You have great insights. But where can people find you? Where can they follow you? Where are you next speaking?
Well, Zane, this is very appropriate because I want you to contribute to the new site that we created, connectionculture.com. And I love the piece you wrote about just actions to boost employee engagement. I'd love to feature that on our site, too. And on the site, we have a quiz, a 9-question quiz that people can take that will tell them what type of culture they work in, whether it's connection, control, or indifference. And I just encourage people to go there. And there's a lot of resources. We're looking, you know, we're bringing in contributors like you, Zane, who have a lot to say about employee engagement, leadership, and culture.
Well, thank you for that, and I look forward to participating and adding some thoughts there. Thanks for the invitation there. And, you know, you hear me hesitating. I hate to say goodbye because it's been a delight. I knew it was going to be great. Your book was great. You've got to change this manifesto out. You've got your ongoing series of 100 connection tips at your site, michaelleestollard.com. So... let's talk again anytime you want, but when you have your next book come out, I know it'll be even greater. And in the meantime, go Horned Frogs.
Yep, go Frogs. Well, thank you, Zane. I appreciate it. It's a real pleasure to be on your program, and I so appreciate your work. We're both trying to make the workplace healthier and just more high-performance-oriented. So thanks for your work.
Sure, thank you. So everyone, it's Michael Lee Stollard. Go get his book, The Connection Culture. Get it, read it, do it. You know, as Michael said, let's make this a happy place where we can work and live in. Michael, take care.
Thank you, Zane.